Well, here in the first half hour of Issues Etc., some movie reviews with Brian Gadawa, a regular guest here on the program. The movie I'm most curious about, I have not seen it yet, but the movie I'm most curious about is The Exorcism of Emily Rose. Well, the reviews I've been reading online are all glowing. We'll see whether Brian recommends this latest Exorcist movie, not in the theme of The Exorcist, but latest exorcism movie here in the first half hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We'll be talking about that, among other movies, with Brian Gadawa, author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Films with Wisdom and Discernment. Then, a little later in this first hour, Father Ed Richard joins us. We're going to be talking about Vatican Seminary reviews that will be focusing on a number of things, including homosexuality in Roman Catholic seminaries. Father Ed Richard joins us from Kenrick Glennon Seminary here in St. Louis to round off the first hour of Issues Etc. That's followed by a short conversation with Dr. William Dembski. You might recognize the name. He is one of the leading proponents of intelligent design. There's a court case in Pennsylvania involving the usual suspects: intelligent design, a classroom, and the teaching of evolution. We'll find out what it's all about and what makes intelligent design different from creation science, or sometimes called old earth creationism. We'll be talking about that after our conversation with Dr. William Dembski. A question I want to just pose to you during a little bit of open lines there in the second hour. I still hold to a literal view of a six-day creation. I talked about this on the air some time back. This is the way I was raised. It was simply assumed in the church I was raised in that God created the world in 6 days, rested on the seventh. Six normal old days. Well, of course, it wasn't long before I discovered that there were people, Christians, who didn't hold that view. They read that word days to mean something longer, quite a bit longer than a day. What about you? Do you still believe in a literal six-day creation? Does it make any difference? And then in the last hour of the program, we're going to be looking at the United Church of Christ. They are trying their hardest to position themselves, reposition themselves. Remember their ad campaign, God is still speaking? Well, we're going to be hearing from some of the officers, newly elected officers of that mainline Protestant denomination, the United Church of Christ. And what I want you to do during the last hour, as we listen to that and some other audio from the UCC, is listen carefully and then listen and find the buzzwords. You know what buzzwords are? Little bits of jargon that we toss out that are, well, are code for many and various ideas. I want you to listen for the religious buzzwords as we talk about the UCC in the third hour of Issues, etc. Brian Gadawa is a regular guest here on the program. He's a screenwriter in Southern California and author of the book Hollywood Worldviews. Brian, welcome back to Issues, etc.
Oh, it's great to be here, Todd.
All right. Do you recommend or not recommend the movie that has my curiosity piqued, and that is The Exorcism of Emily Rose?
I highly recommend it.
And why is that, given the fact that one of the major characters in this movie, at least as far as I can tell from the trailer, is the devil?
Actually, this is a movie that was made by a friend of mine, Scott Derrickson. He wrote and directed it. Scott is a Christian. He's a Protestant. And he's actually doing a movie about a Catholic experience of dealing with this exorcism and such. It's based on a true story, supposedly from the 70s, that happened in Germany by a girl who was possessed, supposedly called Annalise Michel. And anyway, this is story, an updated version of that story that's based on the true story. And what it basically is it is a court case where a girl had died in the course of being exorcised by a Catholic priest, and so the Catholic priest is on trial for, you know, negligent manslaughter, and so he has to defend himself, and the court case ends up becoming a court case of proving demon possession versus claiming that the girl had epilepsy and some other sicknesses. And so it's sort of an interesting combination of, like, L.A. Law meets The Exorcist, you know? So it's like a courtroom movie with supernatural horror elements to it. The reason why I recommend it is because it is a movie that, in the context of our current culture, that tends to, you know, many aspects of the culture tend to negate the supernatural. You know, we live in a Well, we live in a postmodern culture, but there's also much modernism still left that tends to believe that only science is the ultimate source of truth and knowledge, and religion and supernatural is all just a matter of opinion and belief and can't prove it, and so you really can't believe that it's true. It's just personal belief. But in this movie, it forces us to face and ask ourselves the questions of, is the supernatural real, and can we just wipe it away with our naturalistic prejudices and biases? And I think that that's a great, great tool within the context of our society.
The other thing I found intriguing, well, a couple of things I found intriguing about the movie is that, as far as I could tell from the trailers I've seen several times, the experience of the demon possession is kind of told from the girl's viewpoint. It's not so much about watching her head spin around,
yes,
as it is about kind of going through that harrowing experience with her.
Yeah, and this is a more, in a sense, this depiction of possession in this movie is a lot more realistic and naturalistic than, say, The Exorcist. You know, you don't have spitting up pea soup, and you don't have head turning around. You know, there obviously are some strange contortions that occur, but it's not dramatic special effects is the point. It's all stuff that could technically be real. So he was shooting for a realistic version of exorcism. And that's where it sort of, The Exorcist movie itself was certainly a little bit more realistic than most of the demon movies that preceded it. But this movie takes it one step further and makes it even more real in that here's what it might actually be like based on an actual experience, you know? And I like that because it's not gory, it's not bloody. It really deals with the supernatural, the unknown, and the whole point of the story, I think, is to really charge people with this idea that, look, you know, there is a supernatural realm. We don't understand it, but it really is there, and we can't just ignore it. And I really, really enjoy that. Now, it's got a very distinctly Catholic experience involved in it because that's what the case was. So you have these visions of the Virgin Mary and stuff like that. That theologically, let's put it this way, I wouldn't support it theologically by any means. You know, among which some of the points are that a believer can actually become possessed and this kind of stuff. But you know, it's not without its faults. But I think that overall, it's got a very positive. It's a positive answer to much of the, anti-supernaturalism that still reigns in our age. And it's just a scary story. You know, if you like thrillers and supernatural stories, it's a scary story. But it's not just scary to be scary. It is scary to make a strong spiritual point.
So it's telling that in the reviews of this movie that I have read, one stood out to me, which was a radio review I heard. It was being panned because it kind of, well, the reviewer's like, I'm just tired of people trying to shove the supernatural down our throats, and this is anti-intellectual and anti-scientific.
Yeah, that's, you know what, that clearly, as Scott has said, I agree with him, that clearly shows the ignorance and bigotry of the writer. It's more autobiographical of him than it is of the story, because as a matter of fact, I know that Scott did this, and he deliberately showed both points of view, the naturalist and the supernaturalist, and he showed them with equal force. So in a sense, the movie is almost too even-handed in the sense that he doesn't try to make the conclusion. He's just trying to raise the question and say, look, this is a legitimate issue, a legitimate question. So the fact is those reactions against the movie are just par for the course from the ignorance and bigotry of modernists, people who are bigoted against any viewpoint other than their own.
We're talking about Hollywood movies with Brian Gedawa. He's a screenwriter in Southern California and author of the book Hollywood Worldviews. Have you seen The Exorcism of Emily Rose? What did you think about it? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Another big blockbuster, at least it was promising to be a blockbuster, but is also being panned by the critics, is Flight Plan. I understand you've seen it as well, Brian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't listen to the critics, but because you know they're jaded, cynical people who see so many movies. I see a lot too, but I love movies. They see so many movies that everything's old to them, and what happens is what becomes new to them is stuff that is grotesque, stuff that is idolatrous, blasphemous, stuff that pushes the envelope of morality and such, because that becomes refreshing. Why? Because they're spiritually dead in general, these film critics, and so it has to be grotesqueness that actually gives them the prick in the finger to remind them that there is life, that they are alive, and this kind of thing. So that's my view of film critics. But anyway, Flight Plan is a great, just a great, simple thriller about Jodie Foster plays the mom of a little girl who had, and this woman had designed this huge new plane that's out, and she's flying from on the plane from, I don't know, like London or something, I don't know, back to New York or whatever.
From New York to Berlin, I believe.
Oh, is that what it was? Yeah. Okay, yeah. Oh, from Berlin. No, I think, well, whatever, yeah, either way. But so she's going home, and because her husband had died, and she's bringing a casket with her on the plane, and she's bringing her daughter with her, and midway through the flight, she falls asleep, wakes up, and realizes that her daughter's gone, can't find her on the plane, and there's no evidence of her daughter's existence, even to the point where some people who claim they didn't even see her, etc. And so now the story is she crazy? Did she imagine this? Was her daughter a figment of her imagination, or was it real, and they're just playing with her? And, you know, I won't ruin it, because there's some great twists at the end of the story, but it's just a classic thriller that's just suspenseful and exciting. But I will say this: there is a subversive sort of political correctness to the movie that they play with our prejudices. There's a group of Arabs on the plane, and of course they set it up so immediately you start to think, well, maybe it's these Arabs who are terrorists, you know, because of course Arabs are terrorists, right? In the prejudicial mind. And of course, you know, and this is the only thing I'm going to have to ruin it for you, is that obviously they're not the bad guys. It's all just set up to play on our prejudices, etc. But the interesting point is that Hollywood still is afraid to admit that while all Arabs are not terrorists, all terrorists are Arabs. And they're still afraid to tell the truth in their movies in making terrorists Arabs. And this is another case where they'll play with that notion and then show you, aha, it's someone else that's really not for an ideological reason, but for something else. And that's a very common thing in Hollywood. I mean, I remember that back in the days of Die Hard, long, long before 9/11, you know, where they just, Hollywood has a hard time believing that people for ideological reasons would really kill and destroy. They always think it comes down to money. And that they even think that people who are doing it for ideological reasons are really just doing that for money. And so that's sort of the reductionist mentality of a lot of Hollywood movies, I think, that still don't understand people doing things out of true belief systems. And anyway, so there's that. That's just a very sub-element of the movie Flight Plan that sort of annoyed me. But by and large, the movie's I recommend it. It's a great thriller.
All right, to the ridiculous, and this movie, I was delighted to take my teenage daughter to this one because I had loved the books, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Although it was kind of a sleeper, or maybe even comatose in the box office as well. What did you think about it?
Well, I don't have a lot to say about that, unfortunately, Todd. I really didn't care for it. It was just boring British stuff to me. I do love the way Brits play with words and such, you know, and I had seen the original series 25 years ago. You know, you've got these funny characters. My favorite character name of all time is Zaphod Beeblebrox. But, you know, and there's some clever, clever little interesting characters. And it's basically a road trip story about a Englishman who gets picked up by an alien who's been a friend of his and he didn't know he was an alien. And he gets rescued from him because it turns out that an alien culture is blowing up Earth to make room for an intergalactic highway, which I think is kind of an amusing setup and of course, another critique of, you know, capitalism and big corporations and big government and stuff. And or the heartlessness of government, or the heartlessness of capitalism as it plows through people in its endless pursuit of money or profit or control. And so it sort of has that setup, and then they travel around the universe trying to you know, whatever, find their way. And ultimately, though, what it is, and this is based on the original story and the original books, and the original writer of the series, Douglas Adams, I think it is,
yeah.
Yeah, well, he has a distinctly anti-Christianity that really comes out in the movie, where they sort of mock and make fun of people and societies that seek to find the meaning of life. And so he's got a lot of great jokes about trivializing this, you know, like people worshiping something that says the meaning of life is the number 42. You know, a lot of funny jokes, but what it really amounts to is, in the end of the story, it's a story that mocks the search for meaning and transcendence in life and replaces it by saying it's really just about finding someone you love. And that's a very classic atheistic humanistic sort of understanding or worldview. And for that reason, it's unsatisfying to me.
What about Just Like Heaven? As far as I can tell, this movie, one of its characters is dead.
Yeah. It's a love story with a dead person and a live person. And
how is it different from Ghost?
Well, you know, I actually recommended Just Like Heaven because I want to say that it's actually not exactly what you think it is, and I won't tell you the twist. But it's a very, very interesting. Let's put it this way: the movie is an antidote to Million Dollar Baby, which, you know, Million Dollar Baby was that Clint Eastwood movie last year that won the Oscar that was pro euthanasia. Well, this is decidedly anti-euthanasia, which is amazing. Now, that's from the worldview standpoint. But from a story, it's just a romance love story and two people falling in love and who can't connect with each other because one of them's dead. And so, you know, I enjoy a good occasional romantic comedy, and this is one of those. I don't believe there's any real, you know, sexual explicit moments or anything like that. It was just a good romantic comedy. But I'd like to talk a little bit about a couple other movies that should be coming out. One of them is a documentary called Grizzly Man.
Okay.
So if we have time, I'd like to recommend that.
No, please do. Tell us about it.
Grizzly Man is a documentary, and I think it might be either just out, so you might have to wait a bit for it on video, but it was just out lately. Anyway, it's true documentary footage of a that was directed by Werner Herzog, who's a famous foreign filmmaker. Anyway, it's about an out-of-work L.A. actor who becomes a grizzly bear activist, falls in love with grizzly bears, and every year he goes up for a few months and hangs out with the grizzly bears up in Alaska on national park territory. And this guy became so self-delusional and so turned away from humanity and towards animals, so to speak, trying to befriend these bears and get to know them, and he actually started to think that he actually was the friend of the bears, etc. And while he was there, he took footage of himself, video footage, sort of to help mankind understand the bear, you know, this kind of a thing. And it's all genuine stuff. This isn't false reality. He was actually doing this stuff. But what happened eventually was, after a few years, he and his girlfriend ended up getting killed and eaten by bears. They don't show that on the film. It's not on there. But they show all the footage that he took up there. And basically, this is a documentary that is one of the most powerful revelations of the insanity of animal rights activists without them even realizing it. It shows that these people are self-delusional to think that they are the saviors of nature. They are in harmony with nature. Nature will just eat them up if they got close to it, you know? And there is no true relationship that's going on there, is the point. But this actor is eminently entertaining and amusing and self-deceived all at the same time. So it's a fascinating documentary, but it has a very strong moral revelation to it as well.
So how do you end a documentary where the person who is actually shooting the footage how do you end a documentary like that when they get eaten by a bear without showing it?
Well, actually, interestingly, the camera was on, but the cap was on, so that there actually was footage of the sounds of him and his girlfriend being eaten. But they chose not to play it on the movie because it would have been exploitative, I think. So they showed the director listening to it on the headphones and his reaction to it. And then, of course, they would interview park rangers and biologists who knew about grizzly bears to comment on the man's foolishness, you know. And so, you know, there's plenty of sort of post-mortem sort of discussion, you know. It's a very strong moral tale about man's true place in nature, and it's not whatever environmentalists or animal rights activists tell us it is.
How do you think it, I mean, you've you've obviously had great things to say about it. How do you think it will be generally received? You think that message will come through?
It's a good question. I honestly don't know. I would suspect that critics would hate it because it's not politically correct, but I would suspect that middle America will enjoy it because they understand, even if they don't know consciously that this is the point of the film, I think they understand that it's insanity for us to think that we are one with nature and that, you know, we have to treat the animals like they're humans. I mean, we know that inherently, and I think middle America has those values. So I think they'll respond to that, because it's not about the guy being eaten by a bear. It's about everything up until that point, you know. So that's my point. And so it's, like I say, and the kid does learn a lot about bears that he passes along. So it's not like it's entirely foolishness, but it's just sort of combination of both.
All right, folks, we've talked so far with Brian Gadawa, our guest here in the first half hour of Issues Etc., about The Exorcism of Emily Rose. I wonder if you've seen this one and what you think about it. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We talked about Flight Plan and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and Just Like Heaven. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In about a minute or two before we go to this break, tell us about Nicolas Cage's latest movie. I was not impressed with his last one, but this one, Lord of War, has him as a gunrunner, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, Lord of War is a very interesting black comedy, meaning it's a satire of arms dealing, and it's based supposedly on true events ever since the 80s when the Soviet Union dismantled, and all of a sudden all these arms were now available, and how they sort of spread out around the earth and how people got a hold of them and sold them. And Nicolas Cage plays a amoral arms dealer, meaning he'll sell guns to anybody and everybody for money. And so it's his journey of discovery of how he thinks that he's just in it for the money and that he's not responsible for what people do with guns. But it's his journey for how we discover that he is very responsible, and arms dealing has a moral dimension to it that cannot be ignored. Now, the story takes a decidedly sort of, how would I put it? It takes a decidedly liberal left-wing bent to it. The movie was written and directed by Andrew Niccol, who also did The Truman Show, and he's sort of an anti-Christian existentialist. And in this movie, it's a decidedly left-wing liberal bent, so if you are that political viewpoint, you'll probably enjoy it even more. I did not enjoy agree with the worldview in entirety, but I think it was a very well-done satirical argument, and he had a lot of great points.
Let's talk about that on the other side of the break.
Oh,
Brian Gadawa is our guest. That's all right. Brian Gadawa, you can find his movie blog at Gadawa.com. Gadawa, G-O-D-A-W-A.com. After the break, five more minutes with Brian Gadawa. We'll be talking, let's see, what's the next one we're going to be talking about? A couple that he is not recommending. Sound of Thunder, I believe, is one of them. With Brian Gadawa, a screenwriter in Southern California and author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Films with Wisdom and Discernment. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. Listening to Issues, Etc. What's the relationship between a novel written by a Revolutionary War veteran and the Book of Mormon? Who was Solomon Spaulding, and did he have a connection with Joseph Smith? Our Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for September is titled, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon? You can find out more about this investigative history resource at our website, issuesetc.org. Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon is published by Concordia Publishing House. Their phone number, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon cost $16.99 plus shipping and handling. Was the Book of Mormon given to Joseph Smith by an angel or created from a work of fiction? Find out with the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September. Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon? 1-800-325-3040. Or issuesetc.org. The title of the book again, Who Really Wrote the Book of Mormon?
They've been backed into a corner for decades, but now Kurds in Iraq have a chance to build. This global minute urges you to pray they'll come to a relationship with Christ, the Master Carpenter. This is a defining moment for Kurds living in northern Iraq. They now have a chance to give their children an education, start businesses, develop their skills in medicine, law, and many other fields. The Kurds are Muslims, but during the past several years, many Christians have genuinely given them help and befriended them during their struggles with Saddam Hussein's regime. Pray Kurds will remember the love of Christ that was shown to them in so many practical ways. Also pray for each Christian who lives and works in Kurdistan to be wise, loving, and full of integrity in all their dealings with their Kurdish neighbors. Prayer gives us each the chance to have a global impact for Christ. Get the prayer updates you need on the website missionvisionnetwork.org. missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. The other day I attended a church meeting which began, understandably, with a devotion. The devotion was printed out, and it included singing this hymn, "Cast care aside, lean on your guide, his boundless mercy will provide. Trust and enduring faith shall prove Christ is your life and Christ your love." Well, good enough. But then we sang the next stanza, which had a typo in it. "Faint not nor fear, his arms are near. He changes not who holds your dear." That was the typo. It should have read, "Who holds you dear." Instead it said, "Christ holds your dear." And that got me thinking. We have our dears, those people whom we love, your wife, your husband, your mom or dad, your son or daughter, and you can add to that list of dears. Sometimes we worry about our dear, sometimes even are beside ourselves for fear for their well-being. And do you ever fret because one of your dears doesn't know the Lord? Peter says they may be won over without words when they see the purity and reverence of your lives. 1 Peter 3:1. So for all your dears, pray, live a joyful, reverent life, and remember the truth is not a typo. He changes not who holds your dear.
If human beings can't get right with God by their law-keeping or their observation of the law, then why was the law given? Well, that's one of the questions that we answered earlier today on our Bible study program with Pastor John Lukomsky as we considered Romans 5. If you missed it, tune in tonight to the Bible study repeat at 7:05.
The Bible study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about fall movie reviews. Brian Gadow is our guest, a screenwriter in Southern California, author of the book Hollywood Worldviews. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Calling from his car, Shane is on the line. Shane, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hey, I'm coming into this conversation a little late, so I haven't heard what you and your guests have talked about with regard to the exorcism of Emily Rose, but I happen to be a close personal friend of Scott Derrickson, who wrote the screenplay and also directed the film.
What's your name?
This is Shane.
Shane Rosenthal. I produced The White Horse Inn. Brian Gadow was on our program about 2 years ago or so.
Hi, Shane.
And although I wasn't serving as the producer at that time, I am curious what your thoughts of were the film. My thinking was that it was an interesting mix between the worldview of scientific naturalism and materialism with that of supernaturalism, and the way that was played out in the courtroom dialogue. What was your take?
Thanks for the call, Shane.
Well, unfortunately, Shane, we did already talk about that, but I know Scott as well, and I know that he was just basically what we mentioned was that he mentioned this the other night as well, that his intent was to raise the question of the reality of the supernatural within our naturalistic subculture here, within our materialistic culture. He just wanted to raise the issue of the reality of the supernatural or not is a legitimate question that needs to be addressed, and that was his only intent, he said. So, and I thought he did a great job of doing that.
Another movie that you do not recommend is called A Sound of Thunder. What is it with this movie?
Well, before we go to that one, I want to get back to Lord of War.
Please do.
Yeah, I think it was just an eminently interesting film. I kind of recommend it with qualifications. Like I say, I don't actually agree with the point of view of the film, but I think it's so well done and creative and makes some good points that I think it's worthy of listening to and worthy of watching. And it's a good story anyway. And, you know, like we mentioned, Nick Cage is an arms dealer that has no morality and sells guns to all kinds of people all over the world until he starts seeing that the guns that he is selling are killing real people, including innocent children and such. And then that's when the moral dilemma starts to push its way onto him. And interestingly, the film starts with the point of view of a bullet being manufactured from its manufacture and how it's made into being distributed and sold or sent here or there, everywhere, and then how it ends up in a rebel's gun that shoots an innocent boy. So it's a very interesting, very creative opening to make a very powerful point. You know, unfortunately, I think that the point of the film is sort of saying, you know, that it's criticizing even America in arming other people in any way, form, or manner, saying that I think ultimately it also is a metaphor for gun control in America, saying these gun companies are responsible for the guns they sell. And the problem is I think that the better argument that the story should make or does make is not that selling guns is inherently moral, therefore you're guilty of whatever crime is committed, but rather selling guns is inherently moral, therefore sell them to the right people. You know, and I don't think that's what the movie's saying, but I think that that's the moral point that should be made. That is, you know, we shouldn't just arm anybody for the sake of money when it comes to wars and such, but we should arm and sell arms and guns to those who are pro-democracy, pro-America, and against, you know, the totalitarian regimes around the country and Islamic regimes around the country. So, whereas I think the story is going further than that and just saying, you know, everybody's guilty who sells a gun. And the other problem is with gun control in America, of course, you know, the metaphor does not translate because gun marketers in America do not know who they're selling to. They're not intentionally selling them to criminals. And so the problem is that if in order to protect the rights of the innocent, you actually end up holding back the rights to sell guns and self-defense, then you're going to increase crime, increase the evil, and increase the killings because innocent people won't be able to have the means to defend themselves. So, you know, the translation of the idea of the film doesn't fully come over. But like I say, I think it's such an interesting story, and it makes some really clever points about a particular viewpoint that I think are worthy of listening to.
Now, that kind of raises something before we go on to A Sound of Thunder, Brian, and that is the Christian sitting in the average movie is always going to have to kind of sift the ideas here. And you say, like, this is a movie that you wouldn't necessarily highly recommend, but it's worth listening to, even though you obviously disagree with a lot of the things that it was trying to say. That is a difficult hurdle for a lot of Christians when they go to movies nowadays, and that is, finding something in a movie that you say, okay, I should at least consider that, even though I'm pretty sure I disagree with most of what the film writer's trying to tell me.
You know, I think some of it's just a function of age. The older I get, and the more I tend to realize that I don't know everything, and that there's a lot that I thought I knew that I don't know. And so there's more of a willingness to listen to those who I disagree with than when you're younger, oftentimes, or even younger in your faith. You know, you tend to feel that you can only be around believers, because if you spend any time around unbelievers, it's going to affect you negatively, you know? And sometimes that might be the case when you're a young believer. But immature Christianity tends to be cloistered, stay away from bad people, you know, this kind of a thing. But unfortunately, the gospel doesn't get to bad people that way. And so Jesus talks about, you know, when you grow mature in your faith, you actually go in the midst of the evil people. You are in the world, but not of it. And that allows you to be able to listen and talk to those who are against Christ. And if you're gonna have any effect on any human being with a relationship, rather than just being a preaching machine or preaching at people where, you know, that's heartless. But if you're really going to interact, you have to listen to what they're saying to you and consider it. And then you respond with what you believe to be true, or you respond with the gospel, how you apply it to their situation. But the point is, on a personal relational level, you listen to them. Well, it's the same thing with ideas and philosophies that you may disagree with. You have to honestly listen to them and consider them. You don't just let them get done with their saying, then spout off with everything you disagree and everything you hate, because that just shows that you don't care about what they're saying. You only care about you and what you want to convince other people of, and that's simply just not being Christ-like, in my opinion.
Now a sound of thunder very quickly. This seems to suffer, in your review, from two things. One, its message, and two, it's an extremely expensive movie, and I've seen more and more of these lately with giant budgets that turn out just to be bad movies, not really worth, certainly not worth their price tag.
Yeah, to keep it brief, Sound of Thunder is based on a great Ray Bradbury story. That's why I went. It's time travel. I love time travel. I love the classic story where these guys go back in, you know, time travel machine into prehistoric days, and they step on a butterfly, and they don't realize that that changes all of history because the food chain that was connected to that will ultimately affect even our humanity later. And then they go back, and they see the world has changed. Well, this is a sort of a unique take on that. And it just looks like the special effects look like bad B-movie special effects, and I don't know why. It was like $80 million of the budget. And then secondly, it's very, very heavily evolution-oriented. It's very heavily oriented towards the evolutionary mythology. So you've got all these effects are affecting evolution, not just affecting history, but evolution and our evolution, and all these creatures in reality starts evolving in front of them, and all these evolved creatures, combinations of baboons and lizards and you know, huge apes are the results that terrorize people in the present because of the change they made in the past. And it even affects human evolution that turns out to be amphibious-like fish-looking creatures. You know, it's just silly, silly. The evolution story is just so passé to me and so unbelievable. It's a fairy tale, you know, of a frog turning into a prince. I just get bored with it because it's not interesting to me. It's not real. And so this is playing on that mythology, and for that reason, I just don't recommend it. You know, but I love time travel movies, so I go see them all no matter what.
Brian Godow is a screenwriter in Southern California and author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Films with Wisdom and Discernment. Thank you very much for being our guest, Brian.
You bet, Todd. Thanks for having me.
You can read Brian's movie blog at Godawa.com, GODAWA.com. We remember, as 1 month has passed since Katrina hit our southern coast, followed very quickly by another very strong storm, those who are still suffering the loss of home, income, job, family members in some cases after this storm. And we continue to ask for your relief. LCMS World Relief connects its help for those who have suffered under these storms and other natural disasters with the message of the cross. It is relief that is connected to both body and soul. For more information about LCMS World Relief or to help the Katrina victims, 1-888-930-4438 is their toll-free number, 1-888-930-4438. Or find out more at our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. Look for the logo for LCMS World Relief. We're joined now for the remainder of the first hour by Father Ed Richard. He's going to talk to us about the Vatican Seminary reviews that have begun very recently. He's Dean of Students and Associate Professor of Moral Theology at Kenrick Glennon Seminary here in St. Louis. Father Richard, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Can you outline, first of all, what we know about the Vatican document that, or this instruction that the Pope has approved regarding seminary education, and then what these reviews are going to look like in Roman Catholic seminaries?
Okay. First of all, the document I don't think has been approved yet by the Pope. I may be wrong, but we are looking for that at some time. And I know the media has said he's, you know, approving it and so forth, but we don't really know exactly what it says. But I can give you a little background, and maybe this will put us in the right direction. You know, since 1975, the Vatican has issued already four documents relating to homosexuality. And if you will recall, maybe you, in the news, in the last one was a document that was produced in the last couple of years concerning the legalization of homosexual marriages or marriages between homosexual persons. And I think that this was just another document that was in a line of things that were coming out, and it was something that needed to be addressed after the question of discrimination was raised in a number of years ago by a document on the subject of homosexual persons. So I don't think that this is anything that's out of line or out of character. The question here is, and the real question is, for us in our day and age, today with so much going on in society and promotion of different kinds of organizations and groups relating to gay lifestyles and homosexuality, what is homosexuality? How does one go about determining one's identity? And at what point would one's identification with homosexuality or homosexual tendencies or homosexual lifestyle be a bar to being in a seminary? And I think, you know, we can expect that some guys who have been exposed to some of the promotional kinds of things in culture might approach entrance to the seminary with some confusion about their own identity, but it doesn't mean that they would necessarily be what one would ordinarily mean by homosexual. So I think there are a lot of questions that have to be worked out in that area.
So are these Vatican seminary reviews, are they concerned solely with the issue of homosexuality in the seminaries and then later in the priesthood?
No. That would be one part of it, but a lot of it is about just formation for celibate lifestyle. How do they understand? How do the seminaries approach that? But also, and I think it's an important part of it, is the spiritual and moral formation in the seminary. How well is the seminary doing in preparing all the men to meet the moral and spiritual challenges not only of his life, but also to be a good pastor to those that we are dealing with today? Because one of the big issues that, as Roman Catholics, we've been dealing with for over a decade since the issuance of a document by John Paul II called The Splendor of Truth has been some distortions in the teaching of morality in seminaries.
Let's talk then about if there is an official position on the part of the Catholic Church on homosexuality per se, and if so, what is it, especially vis-a-vis ordination and priesthood?
Well, there's the main position is that obviously a person who is an advocate and actively living a homosexual lifestyle could not be ordained. They shouldn't be in the seminary. On the other hand, if a person enters the seminary with some questions or maybe conflicts about his own sexuality and is willing to address those and understands clearly that the condition is objectively not ordered to the purpose of male and female sexuality as stated in the scriptures, if he serenely accepts his call to celibate chastity and is able to teach gospel morality with complete fidelity, then it's possible that he could be ordained, as far as I understand the official position here.
Now, we were listening yesterday on the program to a PBS feature from Religion and Ethics News Weekly, and they were talking about homosexuality in the seminaries. And one of the rectors of some seminary, someplace the name eludes me, was asked, well, if these reviews continue apace, will they drive homosexuals in the priesthood and studying for the priesthood in the seminary underground? That is, they simply will not talk about their inclinations or their practices or their lifestyle. And the priest in this case said, well, yes, it's inevitable to drive it underground. How would you answer that question, Father Richard?
Well, I think that the only way to say what he said and say that it's inevitable is to make the assumption that our other spiritual and moral preparation wouldn't be such that it would cause a person to be a person of integrity and to admit that these are areas of his life that are not properly ordered and have to be addressed. Our presumption is that any human being is capable of coming to a free choice, living uprightly with integrity, and that I think that, you know, if someone is, certainly if someone is out to deceive us and is very, you know, intent on doing that, that's always going to be possible, but they could do that under any circumstances. What I would say is that if a person is genuinely interested in pursuing the gospel, living according to the teachings of Jesus, and opens his heart to that, that we will be able to work with that, and you know, that he will reveal himself, and we will make a determination whether or not he can serenely accept a call to chastity.
Here's the impression I have taken, and perhaps it's inaccurate, but this is the impression I've taken as I've heard this discussed in the press by various Catholic officials here and abroad as well. And that is, well, look, the real problem here is kind of managing a problem that already exists. If we find out a man is homosexual, very seldom, Father Richard, is it spoken of in terms of sin and repentance. It more is talked about in terms of, well, the question is, can he be celibate? And all, we don't really care what he wants to do. We don't care whether he has sinful inclinations and sees nothing wrong with them, as long as he just doesn't act on them. And
right.
That seems a very minimalistic approach, one that excludes the issue of sin and repentance to me.
No, I think you're right. I think that's why I think that, you know, one has to accept, first of all, that this is an objective disorder towards sin, and that one has to acknowledge that. I mean, that's the first step. And if you don't, then I don't see how you could possibly. I mean, I would say I have the support of those who would make these decisions that you could not pursue a vocation to the priesthood in this seminary.
Okay, then what about other seminaries? Because I get the distinct impression, Father Richard, that there are seminaries where either the leadership or the faculty or the student body, it is the kind of the open secret that this is a seminary. If you are homosexual and don't want to be troubled about it and still want to be ordained, this is where you go.
Mm-hmm.
Do such situations really exist?
Well, I don't know of that as a matter of fact. I mean, I've been around and visited with different people, and I've never heard anybody or had any reason to think that that's the case, although I've heard stories like that. And I think that if that is the case, then that will be an issue for the visitations that are coming up. I would hope it would be, because it's certainly not acceptable. I mean, we can't go into, you know, all of the theological and scriptural reasons that we could give, but it's not acceptable.
And how do you respond to those who say, look, the Roman Catholic priesthood is, whether the church intends it to be or not, a haven for men of homosexual proclivities, and that this is opening a can of worms that is going to make things at least appear all the worse?
I'm not sure about that making things appear all the worse part. Could you explain that?
Well, someone says, look, you don't. I read one opinion the other day that said, look, the Vatican doesn't want to go here. If they go here, they will learn the truth, and everyone will learn the truth, and they don't want to know the truth about what's really going on in the seminaries and then in the priesthood.
Well, I would beg to differ with that again. I mean, I think that we are perfectly willing to be purified and to be, you know, for different aspects of the church to be purified of whatever needs to be done. And I don't think that, I mean, to me, that would be sort of a statement which indicates a little bit of resentment towards what the Vatican's initiatives are on this, and I don't believe that to be the case. I believe rather that we want a happy, holy priesthood that is built upon solid moral teaching, and I believe that's what the Vatican wants. So wouldn't be doing this.
Then finally, Father Richard, if you'd respond to two objections that are commonly heard to the investigations in the seminaries, and that is, one, the real problem here is priestly celibacy. If we simply let priests marry, there would be less of a problem of this all around. Would you respond to that one very briefly first?
Yeah, well, our theological reasons for celibacy are, you know, debatable, of course, but basically our position is that from Matthew 19 on the question that Jesus answers the Pharisees about the questions of divorce, and then he goes on to propose the possibility that some are called not to be married, and that those who have are willing to accept that should, and we believe that the problem here is that we believe that of embracing celibacy as in pursuit of or for the sake of the kingdom is just a choice of one good over the other, which is marriage, and that's why those who have, let's say, a strong homosexual tendency creates a problem for us, because if they're not called to the good of marriage, then how can they choose the good of celibacy over that? That's where I think the theological and spiritual issue has to be fleshed out.
And then with only 30 seconds, the other objection is, and I'm sure you've heard this one, Father Richard, the Vatican here has simply acted in a heavy-handed way. This is a modern-day Inquisition.
Well, it seems to me, if I recall correctly, that it was the bishops of the United States who asked for this. So I think they're getting what they asked for, and I think the reason they ask is because they wanted to have some assistance from the universal authority in the church to carry this out, and it seems to make sense to me.
Father Ed Richard is Dean of Students and Associate Professor of Moral Theology at Kendrick Glennon Seminary here in St. Louis. Thank you again for being our guest.
Thank you, Todd.
Coming up in November, Friday the 11th of November, right here in St. Louis, the premier bioethics conference of the year, without a doubt, and it features many of our regular Issues Etc. guests as well. We'll be broadcasting live from this bioethics conference, the Image of God Bioethics Conference, Friday, November the 11th, here in St. Louis. Now, it's difficult, very difficult, I can tell you as a former parish pastor, for a pastor who's busy with all the duties of his call and of his ministry to keep up on the cutting edge of all of these issues. This is a great opportunity for you to send your pastor to this bioethics conference where he can get a refresher course and a tutorial in many issues that he needs to know about as a pastor in the modern world of bioethics, as Wesley Smith says, the brave new world of bioethics. It's Friday, November the 11th. For more information, go to our website and look for the Image of God Bioethics Conference logo there at the homepage, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org. When we come back, hour two, Dr. William Dembski will join us to talk about intelligent design.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.